Today's Thursday, October 31st, and we're having Michael Hodson and Richard Wolf with us to talk about the legacy of the Biden administration for the next president of the United States. And let's start with Richard. How do you find it right now? Two important conflicts, one in Ukraine and the other one is in the Middle East, that we know that the next president of the United States should confront these two difficulties. And on the other hand, we're going to talk about tariffs as well. But when it comes to these two conflicts, what's your take on that?
Well, I think like a number of what I would think of as the most important issues facing this country, the two candidates have little or nothing to say. So, as far as I can tell, there is a slight difference in the sense that there is speculation that Mr. Trump is not so eager to be persistent about Ukraine, and rather more eager to be persistent about Israel and bashing China. On the other hand, the Democrats seem to think that their success lies in doing what the Republicans do, just not so quickly, not so harshly, but otherwise to take their cue. Therefore, I don't think it's going to make all that much difference on these two issues what exactly happens. When you add the social forces that are behind all of this, they will be more important in shaping what the president, whoever it is, does than anything they say in general and anything they say during a campaign in particular, when kind of they say whatever their polls suggest will get them more votes. So this is like so much about our elections. This is a theater. I like to call it the theater of democracy because it's a substitute for the real thing, which they do not want. Let me put this another way. In my view, what we are experiencing, what we are living through, the three of us plus everybody else on this planet, is the decline of the American empire. And it takes a variety of forms, foreign and domestic. But I think in the end, the Ukraine war is a kind of gesture, a kind of shadow boxing in which the United States is trying to convince itself, its allies, and as much of the world as possible that it's the global dominant power that it used to be. And unfortunately, it is demonstrating exactly the opposite, although they don't want to face it yet. They can't allow it to be discussed. And so the two candidates say nothing like that. Do not admit it. Do not deal with it. Do not suggest ways that the United States can rationally deal with the decline of its own empire. They are engaged in a combination of denial and desperate pretense. And basically, I think that's largely what's going on in Israel as well. Israel is trying to hold on to an impossible situation. And the only country that gives it any significant support is the United States, because it has a vague notion that Israel will be its local leader in that part of the world, the Middle East, and is hoping to hold on to the fantasy that that's actually possible. And it isn't, in my judgment. I think that's hopeless. But the desperation is causing a lot of people to die and having the effect of mobilizing the alliances of Russia and China, of both of them and India, of BRICS as a challenge to the West. It is accelerating what it was designed to stop. And they don't see that either. So it's full speed ahead doing all of these things. Now, I could be wrong, of course, but that's, if you ask how I see all of this, that's the framework within which I see it. You have two political parties who agree on all of the most important things, that capitalism is the greatest thing since sliced bread, that there is no alternative that needs to be discussed, there is no option, and that the maintenance of capitalism equals the celebration of freedom and democracy, and that everything the United States does in the world, it does to expand the realm of freedom and democracy against the evil alternatives that beset this project. They used to be called socialism and communism, and now they're called authoritarianism, but it's the same game. It's even got the same players. They've barely changed their uniforms, so we can all recognize who you mean, and the hypocrisy of it all is right on display, as it always was, and it's overwhelmed by propaganda, and the two political parties do their part by being utterly silent on all of it.
Michael, John.
Well, I think Richard and I have been making this point through all of your shows, and I think that a lot of the American voters are in agreement. Certainly, they're in agreement that both presidential candidates are just frontmen for the deep state, or whatever you want to call it, Wall Street, and their financial backers. And the result of people finally catching on is that what's coming up next Tuesday is a typical American election. Who are you going to vote against? The question's always the same. Who's worst? All that the Harris lady can say is, well, I'm not Trump. And Trump can say, well, I'm not Harris. And the Trump haters are going to vote Democratic. And voters who are disgusted with Biden and Harris and are going to vote for Trump. But voters against Biden, two big wars, are going to try to vote for Jill Stein. And I'm sure when it's all over, they're going to find the margin of Trump's victory over Harris, certainly in the swing states, is going to be less than the large, the Jill Stein third party vote. And the Democrats are going to say, oh, we would have won if it wouldn't have been a third party. That's the one thing we can never have in the United States. We have to make it even harder for there to be any real choice of a third party in the United States. There must be no alternative. And the issue is all going to be personified, that Richard just described as what the underlying force is. I think the Democrats are going to lose because Harris has come out as the war party candidate. And I guess you could say the election is going to be, which war do you think is more important? Harris is defending Ukraine. Trump is defending Israel. But basically, the Democrats are the war party. And I think that's what's going to defeat her in Michigan, in Minnesota, and other key states, her war party stance. Yesterday in the magazine, The National Interest, General Bill Hodges, one of the big generals in the U.S. and another national security general, gave a plea to American voters. You must vote for Jill for Kamala Harris, because otherwise Russia's going to march, you know, right through to recapture East Germany on its way to the Atlantic. We must stop Russia. This election is over. Do you want to stop Russia or not? Where for Trump, it's saying this election is over. Do you want to stop Chinese economic domination of the U.S. economy or not? In other words, pick your enemy. And it's the enemy that is defining the candidate, because neither candidate has anything positive to offer the people. So all you can do is play on everybody's resentment against the economy and try to channel that resentment toward the opposite party. So it's a purely negative kind of election. There's no longer an election over what kind of parties do you want. And I think, as Jill Stein said on your show a few months ago, Nima, that she agrees with what Harris is saying, and what the left wing of the Democratic Party, such as AOC, is saying. A vote for Jill Stein against the war is a vote for Donald Trump. And we're okay with that, because I don't think there can really be any progress beyond the dilemma that Richard is talking about, as long as the Democrats are really in power to sort of pretend to be the alternative to the Republicans. And I think that if this election ends the way I expect it to be, and the Democrats will lose not only the presidency, but the Congress and the Senate as well, that will mean that it's not possible for them to win an election again without somehow moving away from their right-wing basis. There have been some polls that the newspapers don't talk about, and that is that Bernie Sanders was the most popular politician within the Democratic Party. Suppose that there would have been presidential primaries like every other party's had for the last 100 years. Suppose people had earlier said, you know, Biden is really senile. We can't let him run again. We've got to let the voters choose who an alternative will be. Harris could not have won a single state, just like in 2016. And Bernie Sanders would have won. The Democrats said, we know that's going to happen. We would rather lose with Harris than win with Bernie. Just as in 2016, they would rather lose with Hillary than win with Bernie. So that shows how the rottenness of the choice that's put before the American people, because the election is not going to be about the problems of American militarism and the empire and the domination of Wall Street that Richard and I have been talking about on your show for the last few months.
Richard, do you want to add something, Richard?
Yes, I want to throw an idea out for you and for Michael to play with. And here, I'll be blunt, so I won't be able to develop the nuances of this. A very short time ago, the head of Apple, Mr. Cook, went on a trip to China. He's made many trips to China, and more than one this year. But he recently made one. And it was crystal clear by the very warm reception he got and by his own very enthusiastic, positive commentary on China, that, and here comes the jump, that there are sections of America's most important, biggest businesses that do not want a war with China. They do not want this conflict. They have become the giant successes they have been because of what China enabled them to do. They know it. They don't want to lose that. There is nothing to substitute for what they get out of China, which, to be blunt, is cheap labor and the biggest expanding market on earth. To give those up is to risk their entire business operation. Okay, now, at some point, especially were Mr. Trump to win, these people are going to possibly begin to think like Michael just spoke. They're going to say, these two parties are a disaster. They are involving us in one dead-end war or conflict after another. And while it may be good for the military-industrial complex, we are, after all, a bigger section of this economy than they are. We, the high-tech industries, we, all the rest of the economy, other than the military-industrial complex. At which point, an immense conflict breaks out in the ranks of capitalists, those who want to cut a deal with China and the BRICS, work out how we live and let live one another on this planet, who don't want war and who don't want nuclear war and who don't want Jake Sullivan type people playing around that problem, versus the military-industrial complex and those who are won over by them. It will be a split, bitter conflict over which way American foreign policy goes. It will be decided in Congress, and so each of those two wings will begin to appeal to the public for mass support to their two different programs. Go the way we are, saber rattling down the road, or go in the alternative direction, work out a deal with Russia, China, the Arab world, and so on, at the expense of the West, including Israel, Western Europe, and so on, no question. Do we do that, or do we, and pardon my humor, have a capitalist peace movement alliance which actually wins? Why? Because the peace movement can be the most popular base, and that wing of the capitalists will fund the creation of that base into a voting majority. If I'm right, that's the next step of American political life, which will burst on the scene because of the crazy things that are going to happen next in Ukraine and in the Middle East. No matter who wins, that will force the thing I've just described, which will either happen or it won't. But it is a possible scenario that has come into my mind as I watch the lunacy. And just one last thing. I know you mentioned we might discuss it. But if Mr. Trump has to carry through the notion of putting tariffs on everything, which is what he said he is going to do, with the uptick in inflation, I don't know if you saw today's data, the inflation is back. But that's nothing compared to what would happen if you actually did that tariff stupidity. And I also begin to think that the United States is beginning to recognize what somebody ought to call the Hegelian moment of American politics. And here it is. The culmination of the Cold War and the years since that aimed to isolate socialism, isolate Russia, isolate China, is reaching its peak, which takes the form of the isolation of the United States.
Yeah, if you isolate everybody else, then you end up leaving them all together and you're isolated. That's exactly right. So this is a new kind of isolationists. In the past, the isolationists were always against war. Today, you're saying
is the opposite.
The isolationists have led to war.
Yeah, because the war is a self-delusional gesture. It's the person who is losing the battle who. Well, I'll give you an example from the Ukrainian war. The Ukrainians are losing, and they take their best troops and invade an unimportant corner of Russia. I mean, that's pure symbolic gesture. That can't work, and it is now coming to its pathetic end, as anybody who paid attention would have presumed it would. That's an act of desperation, as would be sending missiles into the heart of Russia, which Mr. Zelensky wants to do. He's desperate, which I understand that he's desperate, and these are the behaviors of a desperate character, but they're not to be taken seriously on their face value. He calls it a victory plan. That's hysterical. What? You have no plans at all, let alone a victory. Your plan is how to get out of that country in time when the troops arrive. That's the only plan left for you.
When, Michael, do you want to add something?
Yeah. What? Why on earth would Zelensky have invaded the Kursk area? The answer is it's all about the narrative. He didn't invade to win the war. He invaded because he thought that that would convince somehow the egotistical, narcissistic American Cold Warriors that this enables a narrative to be said, Ukraine has fought back, Russia invaded us, we're going to invade it. There better be a peace, and if there's a peace, there'll have to be a ceasefire, and Russia cannot continue to mop up and continue the plan that Putin has announced of denazifying Ukraine and protecting itself against NATO. So it's the fight over the narrative. And nobody on this show, you know, when Richard and I naturally are saying, what is in the capitalist interest? What is in America's interest? What is in foreign countries' interest? And there are people who are not interested in America's interest. They're interested in their own interests. And to distract people's attention from the American national interest, if there's an American election, they have to have a different narrative, a narrative in which they're protecting the weak democratic Ukrainians against the authoritarian Russian invaders who are not going to stop at Ukraine, but are just going to continue to march west over the rest of Europe. It's all somehow there's a belief on the American Cold Warriors that they can create a narrative that will convince people to somehow find the fight between good and evil as seen, depicted by the CIA and the American military is more important. And certainly confuse people is what the real world's fight between good and evil, between civilization and barbarism is. And I think the ideas that Richard and I have said on your show is that the new force of civilization that is taking place in isolation from the West is the global majority and the BRICS. And the barbarism is the attack on the BRICS, the US-NATO attacks, trying to preserve this defunct American power that is only predatory, not productive, only extractive, not productive, and not leaving living standards, only polarizing, not democratizing. So I think that this is, you could look at these military wars that are going on as wars between two narratives of what is good and what is evil, what is black and what is white.
And when it comes, Richard and Michael, when it comes to these two conflicts in the Middle East and in Ukraine, we want to see what's the difference between the Democratic Party and Republican Party. Donald Trump, in his recent interviews, he was just talking that I'm going to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine in 24 hours, as he put it out. And in the Middle East, he said, I'm not interested in a direct conflict, in a direct war with Iran. J.D. Vance, in his latest interview, he mentioned the same thing, that we are not, Israelis are trying to drag us into a war with Iran, but we are not interested in going to war with Iran. This is one side of the story. On the other hand, Donald Trump is talking about that Mike Pompeo, Nikki Haley, Tom Cotton, these people are going to be in his administration if he wins. Here is what Mike Pompeo said on Fox News, specifically about the conflict in Ukraine. He says Donald Trump doesn't know what he's talking about.
I don't know what he's talking about. I do know that we were able to deter Vladimir Putin from doing precisely what he did, invade Europe. He's killed innocent Ukrainian civilians. That didn't happen on our watch, right? Putin takes a fifth of Ukraine under President Obama, not an inch, while I was Secretary of State, and then goes at it again as soon as we leave. So I'm convinced we could have convinced Vladimir Putin not to have done this. Putting it back in the box is going to require real American seriousness, real American leadership, the preparedness to help the Ukrainians do the things that they need to do.
Yeah, put him back in the box. It seems that they can do whatever they just desire to do. Richard, jump in, please.
Well, this has deep roots in the United States, very deep roots. Going back to our start as a colony, the Puritans, this way of thinking that the world is to be captured by a great struggle between good and evil, this obliterates all the complicated relationships that make things happen. It reduces it, and they know that, but we don't tell our people what the issues are. We don't explain. We have no history of it. We barely do it in the university with the tiny minority of people that even bother to go to the university, and the tiny minority of them who actually read and listen to what goes on. I spent my life in the university. I did the best I could, but I'm not crazy. I know what my students did and didn't do. And I learned what holds them back from learning. To give you an example, there's this need to demonize the enemy. Everything is about Mr. Putin. I got news for you. Like any other leader, he is very much shaped by the situation he's in. He's not some free actor, somebody like a devil in the notion of God versus the devil, somebody who has no constraints. Obviously, God, if he is all powerful, should have gotten rid of the devil, but he couldn't. I guess something happened that made the devil survive the God. And we know the stories, so we can learn them when we're little. And so we have these great actors who are acting out their intrinsic social role, but there's no analysis of why they do what they do. So everybody is free to define the devilishness. So for Mr. Pompeo, and he's not original in this, by the way, he's not original in anything else either. He has picked up the story that Mr. Putin wants to march to the ocean. That's right. Instead of Ukraine, he'd like to have a rebellion of the French and the British and the Germans and the Italians and the Scandinavians. All together, he could try to he can barely control Ukraine. What a joke that he could control the others, who are better armed, better equipped than the Ukrainians ever were. I mean, this is so silly that it works. And it works because it touches the good and the bad. The good and the bad. And when people reason like that, it never stops. That's why Mr. Pompeo can then seamlessly go from the bad Putin and the good us to the bad us and the good us. The bad Democrats and the good Republicans. We're God. The Democrats are junior devil. That's why they made a deal with the senior devil. And this is childish. This is reading the comic book instead of reading the book about which the comic book was written. This is a childish substitute for real politics. That's why clowns like Pompeo and Nikki Haley, I mean, please help us. There's nothing there. Nothing. There's a finger in the air. Which way is the political wind blowing among the mass media? And takes her cue. And I don't mean to pick on her. She's no worse and no better than Mr. Pompeo. This is a game. Inside the United States, you paint your enemy as the devil. For MAGA supporters, I don't know, Kamala Harris or the others, they're devils. They talk like that. They're at least honest enough. They talk like that. And for the Democrats, you hear that Mr. Trump and all of his people are immense dangers to democracy. Look at the language. That's why you don't hear much about this or that program. What's the point? You can't have an anti-capitalist program because then the media will destroy you in 10 minutes. So you fasten on other issues where you're allowed to say something like abortion or gun control or immigration. And you pick the, and then what do? You picture your enemy as a devil. So the people who don't agree with you on immigration are evil people abetting the invasion of the... That's the way they talk. But listen, as with any therapy, what we're doing is we're trying to understand what's behind the language. It's no point in dismissing the language. The language is our clue. The clue here is that you allowed yourself, and you had the luxury in the United States, by the very distance from Europe in the beginning, by the importance of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans separating you, to cultivate a notion that you really are in God's chosen country. That's part of why there's a vibration with Israel. They too think they're in God's chosen, they're the chosen people, and they're in the chosen country, and the chosen book, the Bible, said it was their real estate, not those other people's real estate. What is going on here? And so you've had this way of thinking, and now the chickens are coming home to roost, because this way of thinking, we are the exception, you know, American exceptionalism. God created us. Our politicians have to be talking to God all the time. Politicians in European countries don't do that. If they stood up and said, I'm talking to God, there'd be a paddy wagon come to pick them up and take them to the sanitarium. Nobody wants to hear this. And these are countries that have the same Christian religions that you have here. But you can't do it here, because everything is infused, and now the denouement, the chickens coming home to roost. You're killing yourself. You're destroying yourself by turning that language onto one another. And now we are a country split in which each side thinks it's God versus the devil. And they're going to destroy each other. The Soviet Union didn't disappear because another country overwhelmed it. The Soviet Union imploded. That should worry people as the politics of America becomes unlivable. Are we headed down that way? That's a conversation we ought to have. But of course we won't. Each side will see the devil in the other, not in the relationships. Because if you understood that this is a language game, you'd have to ask the question, why are we playing the game? But the people that we're talking about, Harris, Trump, and all the others, they are so into that game, they can't see it as a game. The great philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein, understood and wrote reams of material about the games. Language is a game. And that metaphor is really helpful, because you can then maybe take a step back and ask yourself, why are these language games so powerful? Or to use Michael's language, why is this narrative the one that's embraced by people? That's the first step to getting out of this hole, is to understand that you're in a hole. Just like going to Alcohol Anonymous, they require you to say, I'm an alcoholic. You have to begin recognizing where you are if you're ever going to get out of there.
Michael.
What does it mean to be a devil? It really means the other. Yes. And you mentioned the roots in American settlement itself. The other at that time were the Native Americans. Right. What did you do? You want to put them on reservations. So people who, I think the strategists, the neocons and militarists at the top of the planning pyramid in the United States may not think themselves of good and evil. That's just to tell the religious sector of the voters. But what they think of is the other are people who do not submit to us. The people who want to maintain their own autonomy. So just as you wanted to put the Native Americans on reservations, America's policy is, in words that you almost said literally, put Russia back on the reservation, isolate it, put China on a reservation. When you put everybody on a reservation, you have a situation very much like when you put many of the Native Americans on reservations. All of a sudden, they found that oil was under these reservations. And all of a sudden, you found that they were very rich. What do you do with that? Well, then all of a sudden, you want to grab them. And I think the Koch brothers made all of their money stealing oil from the Native American reservations. And they were about to be exposed by the government when President Clinton had the affair with his assistant and her dress. And so the deal was, okay, we won't impeach Clinton, get rid of him, if you don't move against the Koch brothers. And that was a turning point, certainly, in American politics. Well, America's isolated almost all of the global majority, as we said earlier. We put it on a reservation. They find that they have oil. They're trying, that enables them to be independent. They've also found that they're immune from many of the Western laws, from the rules-based order, and can make their own international law order. And I guess for the American reservations, it's we can have gambling casinos and clean up with the frustration of the Americans. So I think the higher the planners who are really behind making this aggressive policy that you talked about, think the only thing that that we can do is prevent. This is a war against anyone who is trying to maintain independence from the American unipolar world order. And of course, that means everybody's the enemy. Well, they're not going to say this is their strategy to the American voters. They're just going to say this is good versus evil, us versus the foreigners. And it's all of a sudden what has catalyzed the recognition on certainly the global majority is exactly what's happening in Israel. The fact that they say God gave us this land and we must exterminate everybody, all the enemies. They're all Amalek. It's a war for the destiny of civilization. And all of a sudden, the rest of the countries of the world saying, well, when the Americans are coming in and have the National Endowment for Democracy sponsor regime change and color revolutions, they're going to try to get one of us to die to the last Ukrainian, to die to the last Georgian. If they could have been able to overthrow the Georgian government yet again, they would like Georgia to fight to the last Georgian against Russia. Which of the BRICS can they pick on next to fight to the last of their citizenry against? America cannot fight militarily. It has to somehow convince one of its designated opponents to fight among themselves. This is the kind of crazy locked in diplomacy that we're in. Gotta stop.
Let me add, just to take Michael's point another step to make sure people get it. The whole world is watching what Israel is doing in Gaza. Okay? Now, what Americans have to understand is what's going through the minds of all of those people around the world. The United States is funding and arming what the Israelis are doing in order to hold on to its influence through Israel in that part of the world. Everyone is wondering, will there be another country, neighbor of mine, another Latin country, another Middle Eastern country, another Asian or South Asian country, another African country that will be chosen by the United States to play that role over there? Will they be armed? And are we dealing here with the risk of this happening to us? And they're terrified by it. And they're worried that the United States is, in its empire decline, going to reach out, if the BRICS keeps picking up more and more Muslim countries. It's got most of them. You know, if it's going to pick up the remaining Muslim countries, and the United States is identified everywhere as the enemy of the Muslim countries, will the United States pick one of them, make that its ally, and have that be the Israel of another place? And that is becoming part of the mentality of the United States, which is looking for those countries. Was very upset when Niger, a small country in the middle of Africa, basically said, you have to leave, Americans, and brought in the Russians. Okay, this is for them a terrible sign of where things can go, like the election in Georgia or 100 other elections or movements or problems. And those countries are worried now, not only that this might happen, but the Israelis are showing them how far the United States is willing to go to protect its friend in the area. Whoa, that's a little different from Ukraine. That's another issue similar, but this is different. This is going into an area with a bunch of different countries, making one your bosom buddy, and then enabling it to become a dominant. Wow. And are there people in many countries who would like to play that role for the United States? You bet. Is that already happening? I would guess so. And what that does to everybody else is to begin to do the worst nightmare of the United States, which is that the world decides that there is one number one rogue country, and it's us. Not North Korea. They're not endangered by North Korea. They're endangered by the United States. And at that point, where are they going to go as there's a burgeoning conflict between the United States or the G7 on the one hand and the BRICS? You're watching in slow motion the decline of an empire. When the Roman Empire collapsed, for 100 years, the conversation in Rome was about the barbarians. A language I believe Michael used a few minutes ago. You viewed the people moving in on the empire, the Frankish people in what we call France now, the Gaulish people, other part of France, and so on. They weren't barbarian, but they were for the Romans because they were the manifestation of the decline of an empire that couldn't stop the decline. We ought to read those books about the end of Rome. They are wonderful insights into what's happening here.
Yeah. Here is what you mentioned that the situation in Middle East is far more complicated. Here is what the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia recently said about the conflict in Gaza, in the West Bank and Israel.
The normalization with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is not just a risk, it is off the table until we have a resolution to Palestinian statehood. But I would say more than that. I would say that it is not just the issue of normalization with the kingdom that is at risk. I would say that the security of the region as a whole is at risk if we do not address the rights of the Palestinians, if we do not find our way to a pathway that leads us to a Palestinian state, because that's the only way we can ensure that we can focus on the future, that we can focus on cooperation, that we can focus on integration. So I would hope that the leadership of Israel sees that it is not just the right thing to do, it is not just the moral thing to do, it is not just the just thing to do to give the Palestinians their rights and their state. It is also in the security and strategic interest of Israel to do so. And that's, I think, up to them to decide.
Yeah. Do you see any sort of understanding in terms of, because when we talk about Saudi Arabia in the Middle East, we know that how close they are to the United States right now. And how do you find the way that he's talking about the conflict in the Middle East, Michael? Do you think that's possible?
10 years or maybe 30 years or 75 years too late. There's no way there can be a Palestinian state alongside Israel anymore. The way that Israel has structured the whole region is a prison camp. And how can you, a state is supposed to have its own authority, the power. The only way you can have a Palestinian state is for Netanyahu to kill all of the Palestinians except maybe 200. And it'll put these 200 on a reservation and call that the Palestinian state. There's no way in which Palestinians and Israelis can live, because the Israelis say the Palestinians are not human beings. We have to make Israel for the human beings only. We can't have non-human beings or the barbarians anywhere around us. This is a fight for the death for them. And certainly Pompeo says, yes, we're all for that, because when this fight is for the death, Jesus will come and he will take all his true followers up to heaven. Pompeo is this religious nut on top of all of his craziness. So I don't think there's any hope for a Palestinian state anymore. The question is, what are you going to do with the Zionists who live in Israel? How are you going to get them out of Palestine? They cannot live in Palestine if there is to be a Palestinian state, or if there are going to be any living Palestinians left. Where are you going to put the Zionists? Where can they go in the world?
Yeah, the way I read his statement is the way I read what Saudi Arabia does in the world. And for me, it is a wonderful case. They are hedging their bets. First of all, Saudi Arabia is in the BRICS, so we know that the United States is not encouraging anyone to become a member of the BRICS. It is encouraging everybody not to do so. Okay, I'm sure, I don't know, but I'm sure that they encourage the Saudis not to do that. Well, that didn't work. The Saudis went ahead and did it. Every country's leadership is now assessing what has to change in their foreign policy to take into account that the global economy is now split between a larger and a smaller group of nations. And I mean larger and smaller in terms of total wealth or total output, GDP, whatever you want to use. All right, the BRICS is now the larger of the two. It wasn't before. The two lines crossed in 2020, and the gap between them is getting wider each passing day. And that means if you're a company, where you source your inputs has to be rethought, because you're going to crisscross this new global situation. If not directly, then indirectly, which can be just as devastating. You have to reconsider where your exports are going to go. You're going to have to reconsider your credit situation. You're going to have to consider who to insure with, what banks to use, how to split your accounts so that you're not maybe too much in one or the other. Everybody is shifting. And in that shifting, the West loses what it had before, and the BRICS gain relative to what they, more or less, I mean, maybe some exception, but the Saudis are busy doing that. And there's a dance here. And the dance is don't make the adjustment too quick, because the United States might then do to you what is happening to Palestine or Lebanon or Syria or Libya or fill in the blank, right? So you can't go too quick, but you better not go either, because that's very dangerous and becoming more dangerous with every step. Yesterday, the United States announced more sanctions, a whole new bunch of sanctions, on companies and countries that are allowing other companies to function there, because those companies also sometimes do business with Russia. Most of the countries on Earth are doing business with Russia, and more of them will be in the years ahead. They're facing sanctions. The United States, ironically, keeps forcing decisions that are going to go against them. So there's a dynamic here that feeds on itself and that cannot help the United States. That's why the word rogue nation, because the rest of the world is slowly coming to an awareness that out of its own desperation at being a declining empire, which is always hard for the empire that's in decline. It was terribly difficult for the British, was terribly difficult for the Dutch before them. The French didn't go quietly. You know, they're still trying to hold on to bits of their empire. So it's very hard. But what the world is observing is that the American empire, partly because it was a global empire, more than anybody else, even the British had achieved, the United States has those 700 bases around the world. It really was a global empire, because that makes it that much harder. The United States is busy with its defensive gestures, is actually making the problem worse. If I could pick a dangerous metaphor, if you've ever taught swimming, one of the lessons you teach a swimmer is if you're having trouble swimming, don't flail your arms around, because it'll make it worse for you. It'll make it harder for someone to save you. Don't do that. Someone ought to tell the United States, that's what you're doing. You're going to go down faster, further, because of your refusal to deal with what your situation actually is and the desperate ways you're holding on.
Well, you mentioned the Roman Empire before as a decline, and there are a number of differences. Many of the Romans kept leaving the empire to join the barbarians because they thought the barbarians were more civilized. I can imagine American engineers, German engineers, others emigrating to Russia, China, and the BRICS countries where they want to do that. That's one similarity. But also, many of the Germans began to become the Roman empires. There were fights among rival Roman empires, and they would hire the Germans as their troops, and the Germans ended up as the popes. Well, the equivalent there would be if American expanding to China and Asia and the BRICS, if there was some kind of reciprocal investment here, that somehow the BRICS would invest in the United States, which is what the United States is trying to get at least Taiwan and other countries to do. I don't see that happening because there's so much of a hatred against the barbarians here that really didn't exist in Rome. By about the fourth century, you had Roman philosophers saying, well, the barbarians have many qualities that are more civilized than are in our own country. They have a more balanced economy. They have mutual aid. They don't have the kind of financial oligarchy. It's sort of the Romans began to idealize an original society where people were equal and mutually supportive. Today would call that communism. They began to try to develop that. And that became, in a way, Christianity. But as that developed, the center of the Roman Empire moved northwards. It moved northwards like to Milan. Then it moved up into the Germanic tribes. And finally, it moved to the new Rome, Constantinople. The whole center changed. Well, I don't know where the American empire could somehow move its center to. Certainly not Europe, because part of the real fight against BRICS began with the fight of America against Europe, against Germany, and against any potential European industrial rival. So those parallels with Rome can't exist. America has sort of bossed itself in. It can't sort of emigrate to, at least as a government, to foreign countries. If America were like Rome developing Christianity, it would develop socialism, as you put it at the beginning of the show. Politicians who represented actual voters and what's good for the economy. And then this would become an ideal that would lead to a world, a universal world. I think you said earlier, there's going to be a real crisis first. And what you're describing is this positive potential outcome will be triggered by the absolute disaster that's going to be caused either by the warmonger Harris or by Trump and his tariff disasters and his economic libertarian disasters for the United States, that will somehow lead, you'd think, the large corporations to say, we're boxed in here. We can't go to the BRICS countries because of the sanctions that have been spurred by this nationalist fervor against the other. There's nothing we can do except to create a new society, and this would, I guess, would be America's version of Christianity. And of course, that was poisoned soon enough by the fifth century by St. Augustine and Cyril of Alexandria, that completely destroyed the Christian feeling that came out of Rome. But that revulsion against inequality spread throughout the Near East. It spread to Persia. It spread to other Near Eastern countries. It was absorbed by Islam that came up. So we're going to see some kind of a transplantation of what was America into other parts of the world. But it's almost impossible to see how this will occur right now, except beginning with a trickle of emigration of people who cannot live in today's version of Rome. Abroad, but then it will lead, you'd think, to some powerful groups acting in their own self-interest, and at least the American power elite are not quite like Roman's landlord creditor class, trying to indebt the whole other country and impoverish it and lead to feudalism. And that's really the question. Is the American economic model going to lead to neo-feudalism? Or is it going to lead to something better that would actually be, in principle, the same kind of rules of civilization that the BRICS countries are trying to create?
Yeah. And I think the very nature of this conversation is telling you we are more evidence of a declining empire. We are beginning to grope around for either historical models or theoretical extensions of things we see now to begin to imagine where this can all go. And that's already a sign that people are looking. There's an enormous revulsion here in the United States against the level of inequality that we have. One of the reasons neither presidential candidate goes near there is because it is so dangerous. The people who have the tiny minority at the top are prepared and willing to spend a lot of money to keep that conversation bottled up, not public, not pervasive. They are very interested in not having that conversation go because they are so isolated at the top of the pyramid with all that wealth. I mean, if you have $200 billion and most people are, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, you got a problem. You need to keep the lid on the ideologies of your people. You need to control the politics. Otherwise, the sheer numbers will overwhelm you. And I suspect we're going to see all kinds of movements against the inequality, questioning the system in all kinds of ways, including a resuscitation of the old Marxian and socialist. And that's going to come back as it has in the past. You know, the comment that that's all behind us is silly. That deserves the same answer that the Mark Twain gave when he read his own obituary in the Hartford Courant. He wrote the letter to the editor saying the rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated. You know, the same is true for all of these other ideas. You know, the worker co-op is not a new idea. It's been around for thousands of years, but it's going to it is already having a renaissance, in part because there is a concrete example visible all over the place of people who are getting together in an enterprise to produce a good or a service and not organizing it in the capitalist way with an owner operator at the top and a mass of dependent servants, employees below. That's being a problem now, and there are alternatives being groped around to see whether they might fit. But I think everything starts with understanding that we're doing that. If you ask that question, then you don't have a war in the Ukraine. You don't. You work things out. You take into account the security needs Russia says it has, the security needs Ukraine says they have, and work something out. That could have and should have been done. It had been done for years before. It could continue. We can work that out. And the same is true in the Middle East. I understand what Michael is saying, and I think the Israelis have made horrible mistakes in now creating a population. Whatever its animosity was before, can you imagine with me what the feelings of the Palestinian people must now be after a year of that kind of bombardment? I mean, it's beyond. And so I understand why Michael can't possibly imagine how these two people could live together given what has happened now. And remember, every time the Israelis had a war with the Palestinians, they explained and justified the violence they used on the grounds that they had to do something that would prevent worse violence. Well, it didn't work. We have that worse violence, much worse violence. And to say now it has to be done to prevent worse violence, can't do that anymore. You've run out of that one. That one's dead. So you got to come up with something else. The Israelis will have to face that one way or another. And there are enormous divisions inside Israel. So it's not as though there's all unanimity about what they're doing. It's a very particular government. I understand the people have supported their government doing that, and there is no way around that. but there are also big splits and differences that also should be kept in mind in terms of what the future may bring. But to go back to the way you opened today's show, Nima, look at how many of the issues we've brought up, you, Michael, and me. And even if you don't agree with all of them, of course not. But these are the issues that could have been and should have been raised as this country at this moment in its history chooses its leadership. What do you say about a country that can't talk about, that we have one president who says, I'll end that war in a week? That's not serious. That's childish junk. What is that? That doesn't solve anything. You're not going to deal with, you know, even if you thought you could do it, the whole of European politics has been turned on its head by this war in Ukraine. The leadership, the center-right leadership of Europe, is committed to fighting in Ukraine. It will be looking totally ridiculous if Mr. Trump ends this war. And that will be brought, and what's going to happen then? The left is already preparing to make this point in France, and they already are the biggest party there. And I'm talking a left that is old, well-organized, knows how to function, theoretically sophisticated, present throughout the society. And I could go on talking about the German or the Italian or even the British. So you're not in a position, you may think you are. Mr. Trump may think, well, I'll end the war. You can't do that. That's not available to you. The implications of this war will play themselves out. And you're not, you'll be even less able than you might have been to shape it, because you don't even talk about it. You don't even allow your society to engage in a discussion that might come up with some new ideas, that might come up with an idea, a plan for how to do it. You know, we're just three people. I really believe in democracy with a small d. I want more people involved in these conversations. And then we'll get better answers if we do that.
You made a very funny comment, Richard. Suppose, indeed, that Donald Trump could make an agreement to say, well, the whole Ukraine war has been a mistake. Look, we've lost. Russia has absolutely wiped out most of the Ukrainian, not only population, but also society. And so let's arrange some kind of peace. This is all a mistake. Well, where does this leave Germany and the rest of Europe? This mistake is not for them, it's not reversible. A week ago, Volkswagen said, we're no longer really a viable company in the way that we've operated in the past. We're going to, for the first time, we're going to cut back employment. We're going to cut back sales. We're not able to compete in electric cars with China. So unless we put huge tariffs on China, which will reverberate throughout the German economy, you know, we're going under. The German industrialists, who the small, medium-sized firm, the Mittelstand German firms, they're going out of business. And once a firm is out of business, it can't be remade. If Volkswagen goes out of business, it can't be remade. Putin has said that if any missile made by the German Rheinmetall firm ends up in Russia, Russia will not hesitate to bomb the Rheinmetall factory. So there are all of these. America has created irreversibilities for Europe while maintaining its all freedom, its own freedom of action. For instance, the grabbing of the Russian $300 billion foreign exchange, that was Europe grabbing it. Hardly any was in the United States for the first time. Europe has cut its ties with all of these countries. We've talked about just America versus these countries, but America, Europe has been collateral damage in all of this. And I think you're right. You'd think the hope would be the French left and Sarah Wagenknecht's left-wing party split off from Die Linke in Germany. And but so far, it's the nationalistic parties that have not exactly the pro-labor parties that have been grabbing power in Europe. Any party that calls itself socialist is usually the far right. Thing, you know, whether it's the British Labour Party or the Macron's party in Germany, in France, or the others. So we've created a mess that looks almost inextricable. How can you extricate yourself? I can't figure out. It's not foreseeable right now. It's a quandary, and a quandary, a problem has a solution, but a quandary doesn't have a solution. What is going to happen?
I would add, I know we're running out of time, but I would add that it isn't surprising. I mean, since the Second World War, we've had this Cold War, or the legacy of the Cold War, that has systematically demonized the left. The communists are the great danger. The socialists are fellow travelers of the communists and therefore more or less equally dangerous, and on. So when the great consensus of the center-right, center-left begins to dissolve, when you don't have yet another American election with a Democrat like George Bush and a Republican like Bill Clinton, but you have something odd, weird, and different like Trump, it's going to be from the right. The people who are going to break this mold, this consensus that is now so stale, the people who have the idea this is unbearable are going to come from the right, because that's what we have as a society cultivated all this time. We expunged the left. The left were impossible. So the first breakthrough will be on the right. I think that's not surprising. The left will now have to understand that the time has come when you're going to have to do on the left something like what the extreme right has done on their side. And the middle, as the great British Yeats said, doesn't exist anymore. The middle is vanishing. The middle class, we all know, has been eviscerated. Now the middle perspective of politics is also on the way out. What you have is a vast mass, 80% or more of the people who feel cheated, who feel hurt. I could add to the story that Michael told about Volkswagen, the detail, which is no detail, that the largest union in Germany is striking Volkswagen. And that's a bitter strike that's going to, and I urge you to take a look at the Boeing workers who used to be very docile, who have been on strike and who have now rejected by overwhelming majority two of the contracts offered to them. You know, and Boeing is a member of that military industrial complex, big time. They can't manage their problems. By the way, the Chinese are producing lots of military aircraft. That, too, is going to become a serious problem for the United States. I think the left, ironically, agreed to Kamala Harris. And here I'm talking about Bernie. They agreed because they saw what was happening on the right as a great threat. And they're right, it is. But the answer to it should have been Bernie, not Kamala Harris. They should have understood that they need dramatic, powerful images of change. When Mr. Trump gets up and says to the suffering American working class, "I'm going to protect you from the immigrants and from the Chinese," That's a good big image. In terms of economics, it's silly. It's a joke. It's not serious. It's fake. Well, who cares? It's a power. What we need is Bernie to stand up and say, we don't need billionaires. In 10 minutes, we can pick 2,000 billionaires and announce to them there's a wealth tax. Anyone over $10 billion, that's it. You don't have it anymore. It's over. Comparable things like that would have given the people a chance to say, wait a minute, I am willing to desert the conventional parties. Like recent polls show, Americans interested in third parties. But Bernie would have then given them something on the left, comparable to, I'll protect you from the immigrants. I'll protect you by taking the money from the billionaires, which they're all jealous about anyway. I can do that. And I can make a new deal. Here's what it'll look like. Everybody will have a job as a right. There will be, no, that's the drama that would have overwhelmed Mr. Trump. Instead, she did the usual, left of center, I'll do this, I'll help working people. Those are genuine, but they're small, they're old, they're precisely the kinds of things that Democrats have always done, which is why they've never changed the basic trajectory of inequality in this society. But they didn't understand it. They were hesitant. If Kamala Harris loses, it may be a very important time to make that point.
Well, this is the problem that I mentioned at the very beginning when I said the Democratic Party's role is to prevent the left and to co-opt the left. Right. 2 days ago, Bernie gave a whole attack on the American working class, an attack on the pacifists, saying you must support Kamala Harris. AOC, his popular follower, gave an attack on the working class, an attack on American labor, attack on the pacifists. You must support AOC. You must support the war in Ukraine. The function of the Democratic Party is a quicksand that just absorbs these people and pretending to be, we are the alternative to the right wing. They will take the people who would like to be on the left, like Bernie was when he joined the Trotskyists in 1962, and just sort of absorbed them and made a deal. They told Bernie, we will put you on some committees. You can do all the talking you want. You simply cannot act. We want you to talk. The more you talk, people will think that somehow the Democratic Party has a potential. By absorbing you, we were crushing the potential. People are now disgusted with you, Bernie. They're disgusted with AOC. They're disgusted with you supporting the war. They're disgusted with you supporting Wall Street and supporting the Democratic Party, saying through Harris and her right-wing, not center-left, this is a right-wing party with a left-wing rhetoric to prevent any left from developing in the United States. So in a way, the function of the Democratic Party is to sterilize the left. And that I think was the message that Jill Stein was given. She's not only anti-war, she's against the pretense that there is a two-party state, that there is an alternative, and that the Democratic Party is different from the Republicans in any way except for its trickster rhetoric.
Just to share with you, here is an article in Gallup that shows 63% of Americans are in favor of the third party in the United States. And that shows everything, but it's not there for the time being. Thank you so much, Richard and Michael, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you very much, and I'm very glad to be part of this. And I learn, and I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, I think we're redefining the quandary in a way that nobody else is really talking about.
That's our job. That's our job.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.